climate change the facts? The Search for a Global Climate Treaty by Rupert Darwal. Rupert Darwal is the author of The Age of Global Warming, A History, published in 2014, and has also written for The Wall Street Journal and The Financial Times. He holds a degree in economics and history from Cambridge University, and in 1993 was a special advisor to Her Majesty's Treasury. You sealed a deal, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon told exhausted delegates at the end of the December 2009 Copenhagen Climate Conference. Only they hadn't. There wasn't a treaty or even a draft text resembling one. Instead, there was a toothless accord which merely listed countries' voluntary pledges. We will try to have a legally binding treaty as soon as possible in 2010, Ban promised reporters. There wasn't one in 2010, 2011, or in 2012, when the Kyoto Protocol's first commitment period ran out. The destination of the Bali Roadmap, adopted in 2007, had been to arrive at agreement on a son of Kyoto before it expired. Now, Bali looked like a road going nowhere. Copenhagen was an incredible disaster. Newly installed president of the European Council, Herman Van Rompuy, told an American diplomat 4 days later, predicting that the 2010 climate conference in Cancun would be, too. The Europeans had been totally excluded and mistreated. It was lucky he had decided to stay away. Had I been there, my presidency would have been over before it began, Van Rompuy confided. His top aide likened the prospect of the Cancun talks to a repeat of a bad film. Who wants to see that horror movie again? As a means of cutting greenhouse gas emissions, the architecture of the climate change treaties had a fundamental defect. Ever since adoption of the Berlin Mandate, brokered by Angela Merkel in 1995, there had been a rigid bifurcation between industrialized and developing nations. Yet, as everyone knew, it would be impossible to cut global emissions if China, India, and other large emerging economies were excluded. At Bali, the Bush administration had insisted on a process that included the large developing economies. One way or another, the climate change Berlin Wall had to be torn down, not least to avoid repeating the fate of the Kyoto Protocol, as it remained highly improbable that the U.S. Senate would ratify any treaty that did not include China. The Obama administration accepted the Bush strategy and carried it forward. Copenhagen was the moment of truth which would test the proposition that China and India were willing to be legally bound to restrict their greenhouse gas emissions, and therefore that a global treaty was possible. There was no ambiguity about the required outcome. China and India had to be in. While the U.S. and Europe had a shared objective to find some way around the climate change Berlin Wall, the conclusions they drew were diametric opposites. This fundamental disagreement was to have profoundly adverse consequences for the chances of achieving any meaningful outcome from the post-Copenhagen negotiations. Although the Obama administration had proposed a treaty with legally binding commitments in the run-up to Copenhagen, policy post-Copenhagen should be based on the reality of what had happened at Copenhagen. The U.S. analysis outlined by Obama's climate envoy Todd Stern in October 2010 took as its starting point that Kyoto's Berlin Wall paradigm was, in Stern's words, unworkable as a matter of both substance and politics. The United States, as well as a number of other countries, would not accept legally binding commitments unless China and other emerging markets did so as well, and they have made abundantly clear that they will not. Stern challenged the long-standing article of faith that the world needed a legal treaty to govern international action. Instead of a legally binding treaty, Stern argued that negotiators should aim for an agreement that was politically and morally binding on the parties. Stern could also have said, but didn't, that such an international agreement falling short of a treaty would have the additional advantage of not needing a two-thirds vote in the Senate to be ratified. Indeed, avoidance of Congress has become a hallmark of the Obama administration's climate change policies, demonstrated by its recourse to the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, regulation rather than cap-and-trade legislation. Adoption of the voluntary accord at Copenhagen had been vetoed by Cuba and its South American allies, so the conference could only, quote, take note of it. The immediate aim of U.S. policy post-Copenhagen was to remedy this and get the accord formally incorporated into the climate change negotiating text. In large measure, the U.S. succeeded in achieving this at Cancun. Briefing the press in the run-up to the next conference, Stern called Cancun the most significant agreement since the Kyoto Protocol. According to Stern, "We reached an agreement, which although it is not legally binding, it is a COP, Conference of the Parties, decision under a legally binding treaty, which is very serious and which covers more than 80% of global emissions as compared to a Kyoto Agreement, which people are hoping will cover something in the order of 15%. Stern's problem was that the rest of the world barely noticed. Such small bore results were hardly commensurate with the soaring expectations created by Barack Obama's 2008 promise to slow the rise of the oceans and start to heal the planet. It was a strategy that came to grief at the 2011 Durban Conference of Parties, COP. By contrast, the EU's goal was to relitigate Copenhagen and find the holy grail of a binding treaty embracing all major emitters. At Copenhagen, the West had tried to isolate China, offering $100 billion a year of climate finance to African and other least developed countries if China capitulated. Whereas the U.S. realized that backing China into a corner hadn't worked then, and wouldn't work in the future, the EU set about peeling off the coalitions that had veiled the full extent of Chinese intransigence. It was the opposite of U.S. climate diplomacy, which quickly grasped the requirement to develop an understanding with China on the parameters of any eventual deal. With the U.S. and China jointly accounting for 44% of global carbon dioxide emissions, developing a bilateral agreement between the two nations was a sine qua non for a global deal. The U.S. side worked intensively to create a strategic climate change dialogue with China. In a May 2010 op-ed in China's Global Times ahead of a Beijing session of the China Strategic and Economic Dialogue, Hillary Clinton wrote that the U.S. and China had a unique responsibility to lead efforts on climate change. However, in the UN climate negotiating fora, the attempt would be bedeviled by mistrust and suspicion. The EU, on the other hand, wanted to use the arena of the UN climate conferences to ratchet forward progress towards its goal of having a legally binding treaty ready for the Paris COP at the end of 2015. This involved cajoling, bribing, with promises of climate funding, and pressuring developing countries toward a destination they didn't want to reach. As Yvo de Boer, the recently departed UN Climate Convention Executive Secretary, explained in a frank interview just before Cancun, many developing countries were not deeply committed to the concept of green growth that climate change demanded. Although many nations pay lip service to this model, most of them, deep in their hearts, are unsure. In fact, many developing nations fear that the intent of the West is to use climate as an excuse to keep them poor and maintain the current status quo. In executing its strategy, the EU was suckered by habituation to its internal institutional processes, the intractable but irreversible process of reaching agreement within the 27-member bloc, which it projected onto the climate change negotiations, where positions can be reversed, apparent progress can be undone, and what happens to be agreed at a particular moment does not determine the final outcome. The EU also held what it viewed as its trump card. Unless other countries moved in its direction, it would not enter into a second commitment under the Kyoto Protocol. This was presented as the EU doing the world a big favor. In reality, the EU was desperate for a rationale for persevering with Kyoto. In 2007, it had already committed itself to cut emissions by 20% on 1990 levels by 2020. Pre-committing itself looked even more foolish, as other developed countries confirmed they were not going to sign up to a second commitment period. Japan, Russia, and Canada, which subsequently withdrew from Kyoto altogether, was followed by New Zealand, leaving Australia and Kazakhstan as the only non-European states to participate in the second commitment period. At Cancun, the EU strategy met with some success. The pattern of the annual climate change conferences is that following a particularly disastrous COP, the next one is more harmonious, with participants sharing an interest in demonstrating to the outside world the viability and relevance of the talks. Unlike Copenhagen, there was an air of harmony at the closing plenary. Speaking for the Africa Group, Algeria said the COP had restored confidence in the process, observing that tonight God had been very close to Mexico. Earlier in the COP, many parties expressed support for a, quote, legally binding outcome, and the EU reiterated its willingness to sign up to a second commitment period in the context of a global, legally binding outcome. Apparent movement by India, China's core ally at Copenhagen, toward the EU's position created some excitement at Cancun and was severely criticized back home. Jairam Ramesh, India's environment minister, explained, "We have to accept the changing global reality. G77, a bloc of developing countries, has been vocally calling for a legally binding instrument." At the same time, Ramesh denied that this shift was going against India's fundamental position. "The cabinet has given me a mandate not to agree any legally binding agreement at this stage. What I said was to keep India's options open in global climate negotiations. I don't want to put India in a corner. We should have room for maneuver for the next 2 years. I admit our position has evolved, keeping in mind India's changing global role." However, Indian Premier Manmohan Singh asked critics not to read too much into that statement. Green growth must have been far from Singh's mind. A month earlier, Singh had told India's energy firms to scour the globe for fossil fuel supplies, as India's demand for them was set to increase by 40%. "Hydrocarbons will continue to be our major source of energy for quite some time," Singh said. India had a different negotiator at the 2011 COP in Durban. The Europeans arrived in Durban brandishing their big bazooka. Melodrama was the order of the day. The chief G77 negotiator suggested Durban could be the place where the Kyoto Protocol dies, or, quote, be put on a respirator just so it will not die here, so it will die somewhere else. Host President South Africa's Jacob Zuma, and one of the basic four alongside China, India, and Brazil, added his voice to the impending sense of crisis. "We go to Durban with no illusion at all that it will be a walk in the park," Zuma said. "For most people in the developing countries in Africa, climate change is a matter of life and death." He was joined by Ban Ki-moon, who pleaded with developed countries to spare the Kyoto Protocol. "It would be difficult to overstate the gravity of this moment," Ban said at the start of a 4-day meeting of environment ministers. "Without exaggeration, we can say the future of our planet is at stake." The following day, Canada gave its answer. "Kyoto for Canada is in the past," Environment Minister Peter Kent told the conference. The EU laid down its demands, all major emitters to back the completion of a legally binding global climate treaty, perhaps by 2015, into which the protocol could be subsumed. That is what a roadmap should do, describe some principles, the process, and the timetable for what should come next, declared the EU Environment Commissioner Connie Hedegaard. Without a roadmap, no second commitment period. Hedegaard was backed up by Britain's Climate and Energy Secretary Chris Huhne, who underlined that the EU would not agree to a second Kyoto commitment period without hard, bankable commitments from other large nations. "To act in isolation, quote, makes no sense," Huhne told the conference. "It would not control 85% of global emissions, and it would not give green energy investors the certainty they needed." The roadmap and the second commitment period are part of the same package, the same route toward a legally binding global deal. They cannot be separated from one another, and we will not let them be. This was delusory. The Bali roadmap was to have ended with a Copenhagen climate treaty. Countries could not be expected to commit in good faith to the formative agreement before knowing what was in it. Like the U.S., the EU also wanted to knock down the climate change Berlin Wall. Quote, "We need to discuss whether we can continue to divide the world in the traditional thinking of the North and the South, where the North has to commit to a binding form, whereas the South will only have to commit in a voluntary form," Hedegaard told reporters. Here she ran into opposition from the new Convention Executive Secretary, Christiana Figueres. "The North-South divide over historical responsibility still has more weight than the forward-looking approach of respective capabilities," Figueres responded, demonstrating where the Convention Secretariat's sympathies lay. Momentum toward a new treaty put U.S. negotiators on the spot. When it came to his turn to address the conference, Stern was heckled by an American student. "We need an urgent path to a fair, ambitious, and legally binding treaty," Abigail Bora told the conference to sustained applause before being bundled out of the hall. When he spoke, Stern denied that the U.S. had been dragging its feet or postponing action until after 2020. By noting that the EU had called for a roadmap, quote, that the U.S. supports, the New York Times reported that Stern had endorsed the move toward a treaty somewhat ambiguously. The EU got assistance from an unexpected quarter. Normally, sure-footed negotiators, the Chinese delegation undercut their position and that of the U.S. by indicating that China might be willing to accept a legally binding post-2020 treaty. The momentum toward a treaty appeared irresistible. As the COP went into overtime, there was a lone holdout. India will never be intimidated by threats, Jayanthi Natarajan, India's chief negotiator, said. How do I give a blank check and give a legally binding agreement to sign away the rights of 1.2 billion people? In the spirit of a Zulu Ubuntu, Natarajan and Hedegaard went into a huddle and emerged with more words added to the text on the proposed destinations of the roadmap. Quote, legal framework had been ditched for, quote, protocol or legal instrument. When legal outcome was inserted at the last minute, the Europeans threatened not to endorse the proposals. India, supported by China, strongly objected to its deletion. At the suggestion of the chief Brazilian negotiator, it was replaced by, quote, agreed outcome with legal force. Thus, the COP decided to launch a process to develop a protocol, another legal instrument, or an agreed outcome with legal force under the convention applicable to all parties. Durban was a triumph for EU climate diplomacy. For the first time in two decades of climate change negotiations, the EU had pulled apart the G77. It then detached Brazil and South Africa from the basic four, helped by China's apparent abandonment of a long-standing position. As Stern dryly observed, this is a significant package, I think, a very significant package. It wasn't to last. At the 2012 COP in Doha, it was back to business as usual, with Beijing insisting on the division between developed and developing nations. Stern said the next climate deal must be based on, quote, real-world considerations, not an ideology that says we're going to draw a line down the middle of the world. Stern's remarks drew a swift response in an unsigned attack in the Xinhua news agency, showing the flimsiness of the Durban platform and just how little had changed. As usual, the United States has challenged the principle of common but differentiated responsibilities, saying that the future agreement on coping with climate change should be based on real-world considerations, and it should not specify different responsibilities for rich and poor countries. But this really depends on what kind of real world the U.S. is living in. For 1.3 billion Chinese, the world is made up of developing and developed countries in which people live very different lifestyles and are capable of doing different things. Between developed and developing nations, there is a world of difference. That's why equality can only be realized when different players bear obligations in line with their capacities. Discussions on agreeing to a shared vision got bogged down, with the EU complaining that the talks had yielded, quote, no progress, and the U.S. opposing references to equity and, quote, common but differentiated responsibilities, a formula viewed by developing nations as the bedrock principle of the 1992 Climate Change Convention, though Stern later backed off. They were backed by the UN Secretary General. The climate change phenomenon had been caused by the industrialization of the developed world, Ban said in an interview. It's only fair and responsible that the developed world should bear most of the responsibility. Hedegaard hit back. It was clear that rich countries should do more than poor countries, the EU commissioner said, but all of us will have to do the maximum we can. China tried to insert language that backtracked from the Durban Agreement on all countries taking binding action. We're doing ridiculous things, Chinese delegate Su Wei said before withdrawing for the time being. Still, Hedegaard remained optimistic. We are crossing the bridge from the old climate system to the new system. Now we are on our way to the 2015 global deal. Instead, the COP became embroiled in arguments about money. Developing nations were concerned about the lack of detail on ramping up of climate cash to the 2020 level. It's troubling that some developing countries, for example, the U.S., are very skeptical toward doing anything beyond saying, we have made a promise of $100 billion by 2020, said Bård Johel, Environment Minister of oil-rich Norway. The reason was not hard to find. As an EU climate change negotiator explained, these are tough financial times in Europe. However, the parties did agree that the next COP in Warsaw could create, quote, institutional arrangements to compensate countries for loss and damages caused by climate change. This is a historic decision because it ends a 20-year discussion on if and how loss and damage from climate change will be addressed, Farhana Yamin, an environmental lawyer and former advisor to Hedegaard, said. According to Greenpeace, it, quote, finally puts the climate change bill onto the table at the UN talks. If Durban was the zenith of the post-Copenhagen negotiations, the November 2013 Warsaw COP was its nadir. The government of Shinzo Abe tore up Japan's Copenhagen Accord commitment to cut its emissions by 25% compared to 1990 levels, replacing it with a new target that implied a 3.8% increase. I don't have any words to describe my dismay, China's Su Wei told reporters. This is not only a backward movement from the Kyoto Protocol, but also a startling backward move from the convention. A crude exaggeration illustrating China's intent to exploit Japan's move. It also showed that other than the EU with its regime of self-binding targets, the moral and political commitments of the Copenhagen Accord, the approach championed by the U.S., weren't worth the paper they were written on. Adding fuel to the flames, as it were, Poland, the world's ninth largest coal mining nation, hosted a summit of coal producers not far from the COP. Christiana Figueres gave the miners a pep talk. Quote, I am here to say that coal must change rapidly and dramatically for everyone's sake, Figueres told them, though she said this didn't require the immediate disappearance of coal. Back at the COP, there was turmoil after Brazil resurrected its idea of creating a formula to calculate historical blame that it had first proposed in 1997 in the run-up to Kyoto. They must know how much they are actually responsible, said Brazil's Rafael Azevedo. Few things were better calculated to widen the gulf between developed and developing nations. It got worse. Connie Hedegaard accused a group of, quote, like-minded developing countries, a new grouping with China and India at its core, of opposing a push to the 2015 deal by insisting on the rich-poor country firewall. Quote, it is not acceptable to the European Union, she said. Venezuela, speaking on behalf of the group, called the commissioner's comments a brazen attack, responsible for seriously damaging the atmosphere of confidence and trust. By then, it was open season on Durban. China requested a reference to an article in the 1992 convention to say that only developed countries are required to cut their emissions. The move alarmed Todd Stern. I hope I'm wrong about what I heard, but it would certainly be disappointing to move backward in time. Not forward toward Paris, Stern commented. The worst came last. Negotiators wrangled over replacing commitment with contribution in the draft text on advancing the Durban platform. Su Wei explained the significance of the change. Only developed countries should have commitment, he told the conference. Emerging economies could merely be expected to, quote, enhance action. India's Jayanthi Natarajan put it brutally. The firewall exists, and it will continue to exist. The final wording of the COP decision demonstrates the extent of Durban's disembowelment, asking parties to make preparations for their nationally determined contributions, without prejudice to the legal nature of the contributions, in the context of adopting a protocol, another legal instrument, or an agreed outcome with legal force. To all intents and purposes, the Durban platform had been demolished and the bankable promises on which the EU relied on to extend its Kyoto commitment turned out to be duds. The day after the Warsaw COP ended, China's lead negotiator, Zhai Zhenyu, spelled out what it meant. Contributions is a neutral word, which can be interpreted as either commitments made by developed countries or actions taken by developing ones. Since Copenhagen, four rounds of climate conferences, interspersed with numerous non-COP sessions, had achieved nothing substantive other than establish the principle of climate change loss and damages, potentially opening the door to a bonanza for tort lawyers. The EU and the US, under the Obama administration, were the two parties with the strongest interest in obtaining a positive outcome from the negotiations. Yet the Europeans dismissed the gimlet-eyed realism of U.S. negotiators and their pragmatic view that getting something agreed was better than nothing, an approach that was driven off the field by the temporary success of the Europeans at the Durban COP. The Europeans were consumed by the desire to turn the Paris Climate Change Summit in 2015 into an all-or-nothing replay of Copenhagen 6 years earlier. Nothing had happened to change the fundamental interests of the key players, and therefore deliver a different outcome. In one respect, though, the Europeans got what they wanted. The false dawn they created at Durban was sufficient for the EU, together with the rest of Europe, to hoodwink itself into signing up to a second phase of Kyoto, just as all the other Western nations were queuing up at the Kyoto exit door to join the US. The EU had invested too much political capital in global warming and too much physical capital in decarbonization for it to be able to pull the plug on Kyoto. If the cost of cutting carbon dioxide emissions was relatively modest, doubtless there would have been a deal done years ago. At Durban, Christiana Figueres characterized discussions as being about nothing short of the most compelling energy industrial behavioral revolution that humanity has ever seen. To expect nearly 200 independent nations to voluntarily and irrevocably commit as a conscious act of policy to such unprecedented economic upheaval always was a pipe dream. So it has proved. Climate Change the Facts is published by Stockade Books. All rights reserved.